hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Angela, and my sobriety date is July 7th of 2004. One thing I want to throw in there is that I am under the category of people who has never had a legal drink. So I got sober at 18. I'll be 32 in September, and I've never had a legal drink of alcohol. My family history on both sides of the family are riddled with alcoholics, and mom's side of the family is where I grew up. I started drinking at age 10. I found people to buy me liquor at age 11 and was getting into purchasing more liquor around age 11, and finding people that would buy for me. I was drinking alcoholically by age 13 and doing things that a 13-year-old ought not to be doing. I grew up in a broken family, so mom and dad had separated. And I think a lot of that led to a lot of the pain and the separation and the abandonment from my father led to me finding alcohol, not as a problem, but as a solution to feel better. And so I lived off of that feeling, like this sense of ease and comfort that came with the first drink. I lived off them for years. And for me, 8 years of drinking was sufficient enough for me to know that I had a problem and that I was scarcely more than a potential alcoholic. Knowing that my family, especially being raised on my mom's side, were involved in 12-step meetings. I know that my mother was. I knew that what it meant to not drink was no alcohol, and I wasn't quite ready to do that. So picking up my first drink at 10 years old, I was drinking with my friend in her parents' basement, and we were drinking peppermint and Peachtree schnapps and Sprite in these little plastic mixers. And I remember this sense of calmness. I call it magic, like this sense of ease that came over my whole body, the sense of relaxation that was this aha moment for me. Like I had found magic, something that nobody else had that I could have. And I drank the night away. First time ever getting drunk was a blackout drunk for me. I woke up the following morning to... This is when VH1 was still popular, to Marcy Playground's I Smell Sex and Candy video, pop-up video, early in the morning, just hungover. And even that feeling, the pain that I felt the following morning from a hangover, wasn't sufficient enough pain for me to say, nope, I'm not going to do this again. In fact, it lit a fire in me that any time that I would have access to alcohol from that point forward, you bet that I was going to strive to get alcohol, whatever it took. And that's exactly what I did. I hung around broken families that were kind of like me. They had a history of, you know, neglect, abandonment, and a physical and mental abuse. Hung around people who were old enough to have liquor around. I remember one of my friends, I'd sneak into his liquor cabinet at about 12, 13 years old, whenever we'd hang out, and drink alcohol out of his apple pucker bottle and refill it with green apple Kool-Aid. And the idea doesn't sound, you know, that tragic, like a young person experimenting with alcohol, but it was so much more than that for me. It was a secret that I wanted to keep. And I don't think that any sane person or rational decision maker who alcohol isn't a problem would think it's a good idea at that age to drink liquor and put it back in secrecy. And anytime that I had access to alcohol like that, I had this obsession that would come over me, like I knew where alcohol was around me at all times. And I emphasize that because I was so young and it was hard to get alcohol at that age, but every chance I could, I had it in my hands. By 13, I was drinking what I call alcoholically, which means even when I wanted to stop drinking, I couldn't. The sensation that alcohol produced in me was so elusive, like I would ultimately destroy myself in the process of drinking and destroy others too. I am one of those that I'm grateful to say to this day that helped contribute to me getting to sobriety early was that I barely scraped the law, you know, a couple slap on the wrist with a minor in possession of alcohol. I've never been arrested. I've never suffered the consequences of a DUI. I've never been to treatment. It's been suggested that I get some help for my alcoholism, but it was never forced upon me. You know, you hear a lot in the rooms of recovery about the monkey on the back, the things that are forcing you to get some help. Like you hear a lot of people say, well, I'm doing this. I've got to do this for my kids. I've got to do this for the court systems. I got to do it for drug court. I've got to do it because of my family. I've got to do it to get back into school. And the fortunate part for me was that, yeah, there were those consequences. You know, my family wanted nothing to do with me. I couldn't make a friend. Nobody wanted to date me. I lied, cheated, and stealed from all the important people in my life that they didn't trust me anymore. I was still young to not hold down a job and not have it affect me. And I lived off of, you know, people's couches. And so the consequences for me were less severe than consequences, say, of somebody that got sober a little bit later on in life. But the emotional bottom that it took for me to get sober was so severe. And I know it. I know that other people, it doesn't matter what age, race, creed, denomination you came from, whatever your background or experience, we all suffer this like desperation and hopelessness that drives us into the, essentially into recovery. You know, it drives us to reach out and say, finally, I need help and I can't do this on my own. And I know that a lot of people will suffer long before asking for help, even when they recognize that there's a problem, whether it be with alcoholism or addiction from other drugs, like they will drive into this before asking for help, you know? And I'm of the belief that some people's pain tolerance for, you know, tragedy, I guess, in their life is different than others. My emotional pain tolerance was at 18 was sufficient enough for me to say, I want to do something different. And I'm grateful that there are people out there that were reaching out to help me. You know, I could get into the war stories of what it was like, you know. I was actually 17 when I started my first year of college, and this was my last year of drinking. And if I were to back it up just a little bit, in high school, I was one of those people that was a chameleon. And if you like the color pink, then I like the color pink. So desperate to fit in or to feel love and acceptance from other people that I would change who I was just to try and fit in with who you were. And it got me through high school, you know, but just barely. And the person I ended up becoming was completely eloped with alcohol. You know, like people knew me as the party girl. People knew me as the go-to to get a drink. People knew me as the ride or die. And what I knew of me is that I really didn't want to participate and act that way, but there was something in me that was so unstoppable and uncontrollable. You know, once you, you know, how do you turn Angie crazy? Just add alcohol. And was a hell of a lot of fun until the drinking got bad enough. And I was the type of person that you had to babysit and lock up. And so throughout my high school years, I just carried this personality trait of being alcoholic Angie. And my friends and the people in my life were superficial. You know, my teachers would say things like, you know, she's just so smart, but, and I got that from so many people, not just teachers, but, you know, outside. I remember catechism classes, they'd say, you know what, she's just so brilliant and she could really do this thing, but, and there was always a but, and that was that, but Angie doesn't suit up, she doesn't show up when she says she's going to, she's not accountable. Angie doesn't know how to have effective relations with other human beings. And it started to become, you know, a downfall for me. I would say about my junior year in high school, I started smoking a lot of pot and experimenting with other things. And I ended up terrified that it was going to take me down a path I wasn't ready to get on. And so I decided that it was a good idea to run away from home. So at 17 years old, I ran away 7 hours away from where I was raised. I went to live with my sister in the inner city, big city, metropolitan city in Michigan, and live with her and her boyfriend, who was going to methadone clinics 3 times a week at the time, in a one-bedroom apartment. And nothing about that situation was serene. Nothing about that situation was focused in recovery. What it was an escape for me, a getaway for me to try and run away from the problems that I was experiencing. You know, and I hear a lot of times too, a geographical change isn't going to cure you. And I will say for me, in my experience, a geographical change doesn't cure people. Sometimes it does help. I think that sometimes getting out of your immediate environment might bring about a change of perspective. For me, that's what it did. I know for a lot of people, a geographical cure or change, if you change your environment or your playmates, playgrounds, and playthings, you might be able to hear something different than the same voices you've been hearing, especially if it's related to recovery. And I think it all has to do with motive. You know, if your motive is to run away from your problems, well, wherever you go, there you are. You know, if your motive is to truly desire an internal change within you so your external circumstances may change, then you have my blessing. Go, give it a try. You know, I see that all the time, too, in the work that we do at American Addiction Centers, is that having facilities coast to coast, people can get out of their immediate environment and go seek a new place, a new foundation, a new place of serenity to recover, you know, without the influence and the noise of the area around you. And I think the neatest thing too is to watch people that do that. I was one of them, you know, leave for a little while and then come back and face your problems, you know, with a new set of spiritual tools and recovery tools to be able to handle life on life's terms without having to go back to, for me, it was drinking. And for a lot of people, drinking and other drugs. So 17 years old, I run away from home. It didn't last very long, a couple of months before I got high again. At this point, I had been so isolated from family and friends in a new environment, I was terrified. And for me, it was not a place to recover. It was a place for me to hit my first real bottom. I was at such a dark and lonely spot that I truly believe that if I didn't call for help on myself, that I was going to end up committing suicide or definitely some sort of self-harm. I remember calling my family that night. My sister was gone. My younger sister was up north. My mom was working, and my sister's boyfriend had gone to a party and no one was home but me. And I remember calling home to my family, and what they said on the other line was, "Ange, I don't know what to do to help you. I can't help you anymore." And they were so right. And at that moment, I had felt so helpless. Like, I didn't know what to help. I didn't know how to help me either. And so I sat on my hands, staring across the kitchen at the knife drawer, just praying that I wouldn't do something to hurt me. And this idea to call an ambulance on myself crossed my mind, and so I did. They came to pick me up. I was hallucinating, and they did tie me to a gurney and let me sit in the hospital overnight until my family was able to drive the 7 hours to come and pick me up. It was the first and only time someone had invited me to do some sort of a outpatient program. And my mom declined and said, "No, we're taking her back home." And they brought me back to Michigan, and I finished out my senior year. It took another year and a half of drinking and partying, no real changes taking place, for me to hit another sufficient bottom. And I remember it was July 6th. I was having beer with my younger sister, she's 17, for dinner. And I had just had about a 2-week span of blackout drinking, partying every night. It was over the 4th of July weekend. And it wasn't anything too intense or too crazy. I had had a lot of crazy moments, but I remember the weeks leading up into my sobriety date, it was just the same old thing over and over again. And nothing that I could do, no self-will, could affect a change. And what happened was I would get up in the morning, hungover, pray to this God that I didn't know anything about to take away this hangover, and swore to him I would never do it again. Just help me get my life back on track. Help me to take the drink away so I become, you know, productive again and be a better student or a better daughter. And by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, after I'd slept my hangover off, I was back to the races again. And it's like I wanted something internally, but externally, with alcohol, a part of my life could not function. I couldn't do it. There was nothing in me that, you know, alcohol was my master. And so it took off, you know. But in these last couple of weeks, it was that same thing, that same feeling. And by 4 o'clock, I'm drinking again, hungover the next morning, get up and praying for something to change. And I remember that July 6th, having that beer with my sister, and this thought came over me that I just didn't want to do it anymore. And I asked her if she wanted the rest of my drink. She said no. I said, nor do I. I went and dumped it down a drain. I remember that night going to a 12-step meeting, and I remember just spilling all this emotional crap that was going on within me, all this pain that I was experiencing. And I remember the people at the meeting were just sitting in a circle laughing and nodding in agreement and sharing in this journey because they too had gone through it. And I didn't feel so alone. You know, if I had a story about how bad it was, they could match it and then one up me, you know. And what that said was that I'm not the only one that's gone through this. And what it showed me too is that if they were staying sober and they were laughing and they were joyful, that maybe I could experience that one day too. And so from that day, I count July 7th as my first real day of sobriety. From that day on, I've been sober. Nights, weekends, holidays, birthdays, events, no slips, dips, or acid trips. And I think it's been a pretty neat blessing. You know, this past July, I celebrated 13 years sober at 31 years old. And there's nothing I love more than meeting someone who's young and new and doesn't think that they belong or that recovery isn't for them or that it's just their circumstances. And if they change the circumstances, they'll be able to stay sober. And I just kind of smile to myself, and that's when I find it appropriate to share and say, hey, you know what? I've been there too. But guess what? If you're one of us and you suffer from alcoholism or addiction, chances are, you know, you and I are a lot alike. And when we change internally, you know, and we start to deal with some of these things that have been affecting us our whole lives, then externally these things start to come to fruition. It's not the other way around. And why not work towards your recovery and your sobriety so that you can have a life that you've always dreamed? On that note, I remember someone telling me to write down what I wanted out of sobriety and what I thought my life should look like sober. If that would have come true, if that list would have materialized, I would have sold myself so short of the blessings that my life really had in store for me, you know? From the angry, violent, torturous, alcoholic adolescent child turned into a beautiful, smart, young woman. My family does want something to do with me today. I'd like to think of myself as a role model for my family and for my sisters and my nieces and nephews. I'm present in my family today. They're proud of me. I've received not only one, but two college degrees. An associate's and a bachelor's, and thinking about getting in my master's of social work so I can turn around and help countless others, you know, who suffer from not just alcoholism and addiction, but other mental health disorders. I'm a productive member of society today. I contribute. In fact, today I had a little challenge with one of my friends. We each had to participate 3 positive things to society. And she had to tell me by the end of the day what thoughtless act she did for school, because she was back in school, she did. And I had to tell her what three thoughtless acts that I did for the community were today, you know, and learn how to give back. Because I took so much, you know, I was so selfish and so self-centered and always thinking about me. And the world is a lot bigger than just me. And when I start to invite other people into my life, you know, it becomes so much more fulfilling. And the most fulfilling is learning how to give back the tools that were given to me early on in recovery and in sobriety so that someone else might use those same tools to recover themselves. And none of it's a secret. You know, I think too, like sometimes we want to hold on to these things that have saved us as if we let them go, that they're not going to be with us still. But I think the power is in taking these, you know, blessings that we've been given in recovery, this insight or these, you know, spiritual tools of action, and showing other people how we've recovered and gotten out from under only keeps us sober longer. You know, it's sharing in the common bond and the common journey of, you know, first our addiction and then how we recover. And today, you know, my life has changed by leaps and bounds. I feel like an odd duck by having 13 years and have gotten sober, never had a legal drink, but I have found a community of other young people who are just like me. I'm really no different. And that other people too have gotten sober young, if not younger than me, and are still sober 5, 10, 14, 15 years. And those are the people that I surround myself with, you know. I was told a long time ago that, you know, what sheep is going to be picked off first? The one on the outside of the pack. And so it's kind of that herd mentality is like, stay right in the middle of it. Stay in the middle of your recovery. Stay in the middle of your sobriety. Be active in that and be a part of the fellowship of people that are just like you. You know, no one can help another alcoholic or addict like another alcoholic and addict. They know based on their own experience, like nobody else knows. I know based on my own experience, like nobody else knows, you know, what it's like, the depths that I'll go to and the pain I'll cause and the suffering I'll give to my family and loved ones in the midst of my alcoholism, you know. And on the opposite side, having done, you know, the work in here is this open inventory of my grosser handicaps and, you know, the pain my alcoholism and addiction has caused, how I can use that and make amends to my family and those about me, and on a day-to-day learn how to give back to the world around me because I took so much. I feel I was fortunate enough to have a family, actually a whole slew of family members that were in recovery, my mother being one of them. And she had told me about certain 12-step meetings that she was attending. And every once in a while, I'd come home and there'd be some literature laying on my bed. And people at her house that were just like her that would drink coffee and talk spiritual things. And my family would ask me all the time, you know, do you think you're alcoholic, Angie? And I'd say, this was my one-liner, nope, not yet. As if the bottom had to fall out for me to finally admit that I was an alcoholic. And the age-old saying that you hear all the time is you don't have to take the elevator all the way to the bottom to admit you have a problem. Well, that was true for me. You know, I had hit a sufficient bottom enough for me to say that it was painful enough. I had caused my family enough harm, enough hurt, and enough pain. I will say that first month was the most challenging for me because I had never done anything for 30 plus days, especially 30 days, stay sober. No, my friends had bets it would be 2 weeks before I'm drinking again. And I believed them because I didn't believe that I could stay sober. And through the grace of God, whom without his true love and guidance, I would not still be here today. And people in a 12-step fellowship were able to talk me through some of the tough moments, some of the moments that were either painful to me or so stressful. I know too, a lot of us, when we first get sober, I am drama queen central, right? And especially early on in sobriety, like if something small happened, I turned it into a mountain and didn't know how I was going to get through it. And I would cry or, you know, express how my crazy thoughts to people and what these people did, you know, a fellowship around me were able to walk me through, you know, not taking that next drink, you know, especially being 18, you've got people all around you who are still drinking and using, who don't even have a problem yet, or they're just getting started. Well, I know a lot of people who are just like me, who started really young, you know, and didn't have to go through years of literal hell the rest of us had gone through to get to a point where it would hit us, you know, and it hit me hard at 18. And I remember the slogan, play the tape the whole way through, that helped a lot early on, because I'd look around me at other people and self-pity would riddle me. And I'd look at what other people were able to do, and I wasn't able to drink like that. And when I took an honest look at what I was actually doing, is I was causing destruction within me, and I couldn't drink like normal people could drink. And then if you take past my drinking, the destruction that I would cause, I would never show up for a job. I couldn't hold one down. I didn't have a place to live when I got here. I didn't have a car. I had lost my car. I had no friends. You know, all of these things that led up to this, well, what happens when you take a drink, Ange? And I would look and play the tape the whole way through. And it just wasn't worth it to me to risk that. You know, nothing in this life is worth me taking a drink over, period. And even in my 13 years of sobriety, I've experienced, you know, loss. I've experienced death. I've experienced relapse of a family member. I've experienced overdose deaths of friends and loved ones. I've experienced moving. I've experienced traveling to different countries. I've experienced school. I've experienced working in a bar and being around liquor. I did that for almost 16 years, you know? And all these things that nothing is worth having a drink over, no matter how stressful it is. And nothing is going to drive me to take a drink so long as I'm staying centered in my recovery. And I fully believe that. And thank God for people who've gone through it before me, especially in a really good 12-step fellowship, who've been able to share their experience with me so that I didn't have to go back out there and give it another shot. You know, I was so destructible at such a young age that if I were to go back out there, I know I'd hit it hard and heavy. And I probably wouldn't be lucky enough to return. I'd be out there for years trying everything under the sun, all the drugs, you know. I didn't even know what a martini was before I got sober. And now that I know, you know, all the things that I could have tried or could have done, I don't have to define my seat in a 12-step fellowship, or I don't have to defend my position in recovery. I know I belong here because I say I do. My biggest thing when working with others and talking to someone who is on the fence about getting sober or staying sober, most of us that know we have a problem, our still small voice is already telling us that we do. And my encouragement is that if you think you belong here, you probably do. And to please do not leave until you see the miracle happen for yourself. Recovery is available to anyone who honestly wants it. And I've seen miracles on top of miracles on top of miracles with people who stick around and do the work and watch the beautiful results. And thus turn around and share that same experience with others. So stick it out and keep coming back.